Session number 4891, reel 8.
Newsreel cameraman, Jim Wright, reel 8.
I remember I was asked on one occasion if I would go with some B-24, a squadron of B-24s on a raid on Rangoon. Well, I had second thoughts about it. I didn't really want to do any more flying, so I said, oh, I'll go. And it was not very satisfactory. The only thing I can remember about that particular thing was the really heavy anti-aircraft fire that the Japanese managed to shove up. That's all I can remember, except that I filmed it, and I don't know what happened to the film, because it was never got back to England, although I handed it in.
Which position did you film from in the B-24?
Well, I think a camera hatch they had there, or an opening in the... a similar sort of opening to the B-17. Wasn't very comfortable. I don't like the B-24 at all. It's not a comfortable plane for filming purposes.
Afterwards, you filmed the signature of Japanese surrender at Rangoon.
Oh, yes. By this time, Rangoon had been taken. But, of course, I wasn't present there. It was not my job, anyhow. Army Film Unit covered the event of Rangoon.
How did you see your job of coverage as different to that of the Army Film Unit? Did you think they were covering different subjects?
No, I didn't. I didn't do much filming out there at all, because it was only when the fit took me. I went into Rangoon with Noel Monks, Lord Donegal. That's the man I was trying to tell you the other day. It's just name just comes to me, and one other fellow I've got. And we took over a house at Rangoon as a press headquarters, because there weren't many press people there. It was in the same road as the government house, I think, in Rangoon. I don't know what he was. They said he was a tea planter, but I can't believe it. But it was a very wealthy man's house, very comfortable, including his servants. Servants came with the house. They were living in a compound at the back of the house, so we had to take them over and feed them. We managed all right. We did very comfortably there. And suddenly the word came around to the press office had been set up. And Noel Monks came in one day and said, there's a preliminary signing going to take place in Rangoon, in the government house. Waffle down and see the people, get a permit to go in or something, if you want to see it. So I went in to Rangoon House. That was, one of the very first signing that Mountbatten had. The big signing, of course, was Singapore. But I was there, but I was invited to see it, and I watched it. But I did not film. Not in Singapore.
Because the Army Film Unit was covering.
It was covered by every conceivable angle. There was no point in adding to it. I mean... there's no point in putting cameras in unnecessarily just because I happened to be there with a camera. I wasn't concerned. I'd more as fed up with the job then. As far as I was concerned, war was over, and I wanted to get back to England just as soon as I could, start my life again. I had all the excitement, all the fun. I had the best of it. So I think I did. There's quite a lot that I haven't told you, but there's no point in it. I mean, just my day-by-day experiences.
I would have liked to talk to you a bit about the post-war period in the newsreel company.
Yes, go ahead.
Did the war affect the newsreel companies in any way, do you think?
In what respect?
They had provided over a period of about 5 years very exciting material, the post-war period.
Well, of course, I must say that it's somewhat difficult to readjust after a war of those dimensions. I don't think the world is ever going to see a war of its kind again. The next war will be sharp, bloody, and very sudden, and it'll end just as fast as it starts. But at least that's what I think, anyhow. But
perhaps what I'm thinking is, in retrospect, the war appears as really the highlight of the history of the newsreel. And you survived in the newsreel industry after this period. Did you feel in any way that the newsreel companies were no longer fulfilling a need?
Oh, no, nothing, no, nothing of the sort. We really went to town after the war. I believe some of our best coverage was done during the few years we existed after that. There were many, many events, and I think we covered them very well indeed. All the newsreels did a very good job. I think we improved, if anything. I personally think the post-war years were the best years of the newsreel business. Tremendous enthusiasm, keenness, rivalry. There was a wonderful esprit de corps amongst all companies, all the cameramen, everything else. We had no trouble, no strife. If there was any trouble, it was resolved within a matter of minutes or hours. And everybody was happy, kept happy.
But already in 1948, Universal dropped out.
Ah, well, there was various things that people gave up, the ghost and so on and so forth. Things were moving quite fast. I mean, the television was beginning to rear its ugly head, as you might say.
Did technology within the newsreel industry change at all as a result of the war?
Not greatly, because there was nothing. Television technology hadn't hit the newsreels. Mind you, we'd heard smatterings of it. I thought there was a lot of things to come. I mean, I remember the days when we were recording stuff on wire, on reels of wire. And people said it couldn't be done. I said, well, one day they'll put pictures on wire. And I remember we had a long argument at the Newsreel Association meeting. Gordon Craig said I was just damn silly to talk like that. I said, well, I don't think so. I don't think we know what the hell's going to happen in the future. But I said, I can visualize all sorts of funny things happening, which might ultimately put us out of business. And my God, those words were prophetic. We were put out of business by television. There's no doubt about it. Anybody who says we weren't doesn't know what they're talking about. How could we possibly compete with the speed of television? We could never do it unless we went into the television game, and we were not geared to go into a television game. We hadn't got vast government resources behind us like the BBC or even any other company, or vast advertising resources of ITV. We had cinema advertising, we know, but we didn't benefit by that. There was no advertising in newsreels. If we had produced newsreels with advertising in them, we could have sold advertising space and sold the idea to the theatre owners, then we would have been sitting pretty.
Did you ever think of this idea at the time?
You couldn't do it. We thought of it. We thought of selling advertising space, but no cinema owner is going to stand for that. He gets any revenue that's going to be got, he's going to have it off his own screen. He's not going to let us have his revenue. I mean, BBC, and not BBC, the ITV, don't know how lucky they are that they can put out the rubbish that they shove out from time to time and make us pay, or they say we're not paying for it, but of course we are. We're paying the BBC a license. It's supposed to include ITV. We're supposed to be getting ITV for nothing. I've never heard so much balderdash in my life. ITV have been making millions, and have been conning the public and giving them a very, very small amount of entertainment in return. At least I think it's small. I really do.
To return to the newsreel, your newsreel covered the war in Korea, did it not?
Yes, Maurice Ford was asked if he'd like to go, and he went, did quite a good job.
for the whole period or just on an assignment?
Only for a period of time. We never like to keep men there indefinitely. I mean, Korea went on and on and on and on. But we were getting very good coverage of Korea from the Americans because the Americans had very good camera facilities there. We just simply wanted our own cameraman to shoot, shall we say, our own British efforts, like covering anything with the British or Allied troops, or the Australians were in Korea. There were all sorts of... When I say British, I mean covering the whole of what used to be known as the British Empire. But Maurice Ford did quite a good job while he was there and came back comfortably.
And the events in Palestine leading up to the creation of the State of Israel, did you have a cameraman there?
No. Not that I know of. I don't know if we had any material. I can't recall whether we had or not. I read all about it, but I don't remember any film of it.
The rotor system ended there at the end of the war.
Yeah. Oh, yes. We went back to strict competition. And it became very fast and furious, very fast and furious. When I think of the efforts that were made by various companies, including our own, I mean, Gaumont British, when the Olympic Games came here, Gaumont British bought the rights, and our job was to steal it. Somebody else bought the rights to the cup final, our job was to steal that. We bought the rights to the cup final, their job was to steal it. Somebody bought the rights to the Grand National.
So the pre-war
competition was intense, but it was very good for the business. In fact, I honestly believe that if it hadn't been that newsreel war, as I've heard it called, of course it was so damn silly to call that because all this was done with our tongues in our cheeks. I mean, after a very good scoop, we all have a drink together, congratulate one another. The general public didn't know that. They all assumed there was a great, terrible newsreel war. Well, there was. We'd cut each other's throats. But we'd have a drink afterwards. You can't blame us for that, surely. I think that's a civilized way of having a fight. But we did more in the post-war period in paving the way for what was to come, the television people, television news, and so on and so forth. I really do. I think
what particular way do you mean that?
Well, I think we made things much easier for them. They never had the uphill fight that we had in the early days. I mean, ours was, right from the early days, when we first started, was always an uphill fight to get facilities, get permission.
Had you not already won that fight, though, on the eve of the Second World War?
To a very great extent, yes, but then you've still got, there's still fresh blood coming along, people have got to, you know, flex their muscles a bit and prove how important they are, and new people, new blood comes in, new broom sweeps clean, and you've got to break that down. Well, you're always breaking new ground in the film business. It was very exciting. I found it very exciting. And it was very the whole life was absorbing. I gave my entire life to it at that time, almost to the detriment of my home life. And I think Cummins did. Well, Cummins lost his first marriage, went up the rocks. And his second marriage was a very happy one. I introduced him to his second wife. And she was an officer in the Royal Air Force, I knew very well, the charming woman, Mary, and she had a bad accident. They lived in a flat off Bayswater Road, and used to take the dog for a run in Hyde Park, and she just slipped off the curb, she damaged her ankle, and she never walked again after that. She finished up in a wheelchair.
Did you remain news editor whilst Cummins remained general
editor? Cummins remained general editor all the time, and I remained his news editor, and very happy relationship, I must say. Well, then, all of a sudden, Cummins told me one day he'd had a disagreement with the powers that be, and that he was going to leave Paramount.
Who were his powers that be?
Eh?
Who were his immediate superiors?
Well, the immediate superiors were head office in Water Street, Powerbound office. I don't know who it was. He never told me anything at all about that, and they never inquired. I'm sorry you're recording this, Mr. Vick. But nevertheless, he said he was going to leave Paramount. Well, from that moment on, nobody knew who was going to be appointed as editor. We just carried on. Each one of us carried on as if Cummings was still there. Until one of the directors of Paramount came out to act, phoned up and said, I want to meet the entire staff. Will you arrange for the entire staff to be ready and I'll see them at 2 o'clock? And so I did that. We all assembled in the theatre, I think it was. And Cornwall was the director, a man named Cornwall. He said, well, we've given a lot of thought to the question of the new editor for Paramount News. And it has been decided, not only by the chairman of the company, but also by New York, that Jim Wright is to be the new editor. He's been with the company since it started, with Mr. Cummings. And before that, he was with Movie Turn, and we think that he is the best man for the job. They turned around and said, Mr. Wright, you're appointed editor of Paramount News as from today. So that's it. That's all I know. So thereon, I had to carry on, and I endeavoured to carry on almost in the same way that Cummings carried on. I really believe he was. A lot of people think that Tom Cummings was a rough diamond. He was, but by God, he glittered like a diamond. He was a brilliant man, really, privately. Not an educated man, but he was really brilliant. He was clever. He had a brain. He thought. He used what he had. And that's all I want in a man. I think he was a great man. I can't speak more highly of him. And I think everybody who met him, who knows him, or anybody who knew him, would say the same thing. I was very glad, really, to more or less walk in his footsteps.
And you remained general editor until the closure of the newspaper?
I was editor and general manager. That was my title. I was made editor and general manager of British Power News, and I stayed with them until they suddenly decided to sell out to the BBC. I was told at that time that they wanted me to carry on my job, but my age went against me from the BBC point of view. I suppose it's because of their pension business. I told them I wasn't interested in any blasted pension or anything like that. But they had their own men. I met this man, Innes, of BBC, who seemed to have quite a lot of say behind his head. I don't know who he was. He was a mystery man, one of the mystery men up there. Backroom boys. Well, that's a loose term, I know. Anyhow, for quite a long time I thought I was going to, be in charge of the Acton side. But somebody higher up in the BBC had their own ideas. I suppose they had their own people they wanted to put in. So they put in, several people went in there. And I think Dickinson was the first one. Then I think it was Dickinson.
You yourself were general manager from what date?
I can't remember the date. From the time Cummings left until the newsreel closed. If you tell me when Cummings retired, I can't remember that. Anyhow, from the moment Cummings, I was there for about, I suppose, what, 2 or 3 years? Then the reel folded.
Was this unexpected, the folding of the reel?
Oh, yes, I think so. I really thought we were going to stay on and be part of the BBC News setup. I'd been led to believe that we would be part of the BBC News. I knew the BBC were interested in the building, and I knew from the visits we'd had, I knew they were looking it over, and I knew they were more interested in our outfit at Acton than anybody else's, the Gaumonts or Murrytones or anybody else's, that matter. Paramount was the one they wanted. And Paramount's the one they got. But they put their own people in. Of course, now I realize that I suppose I was getting a bit too old. I had no technical knowledge on television. I knew how it worked like everybody else. I probably had one of the first television sets in this country. In fact, one of the first people ever built television sets was our own sound man. A chap in charge of our sound department. I've just forgotten his name for a moment. But he built it. I remember the day he first had the picture on a tube in our camera room. However, it's probably better that I should fade out and leave. I mean, I was getting on. I was, what, 50, 55 at that time? Well, you can't blame the people who say, oh, this chap's had it, he's burnt out. I wasn't, but do I look burnt out now?
No, not at all.